Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Right, we're looking at American Cold War policy in the 1950s, partly because of its own inherent interest, partly because it helped to set the content and tone of American policy during the Cold War, and partly because the United States faced many of the similar problems that you could see it facing today in terms of commitments across many areas, and also in terms of a deteriorating strategic situation. Now, that might seem a surprising remark, and obviously today one is mindful of discussion about Russia, China, North Korea, Iran as a major axis, and of parts of the world in the south, as it were, which are linked to or looking to that axis. And one can look with foreboding at situations in Ukraine, in the Middle East, and potentially in Taiwan. So it might seem rather bizarre to refer back to the early 1950s for some sort of historical parallel. After all, at that stage, America proportionately was more significant economically. But at the same time, it's worth bearing in mind that from the perspective of American policymakers, there was the loss to the Chinese communists of the most populous country in the world. There was the pressure on Western interests posed by the Soviet Union in Europe, posed by China in North Korea. And there was the fact that the Soviet Union had rapidly followed America in acquiring nuclear arms, which threatened a kind of nuclear balance, which therefore threw light on the conventional superiority of the armies of both China and the Soviet Union. So there was a sense of foreboding in the early 1950s. And of course, Cold War policy was in part defined not so much in terms of the documents we were looking at last time, for example, Kennan and his influence on NSC 68, but more also in response to the particular crises of the moment and how these gave a shock to existing interpretations, and also linked to that, the impact of new presidential administrations. And in 1953, having won the 1952 general election, Adlai Stevenson being defeated, Eisenhower became president. Now, in 1953, the Americans produced Project Solarium, named after the Solarium room in the White House, where Eisenhower had found his cabinet and government split on the response to Soviet expansionism and had felt that NSC 68 was inadequate as a guide. And it's worth bearing in mind that Eisenhower's background here is not so much as we tend to see him as America, a supreme commander in World War II and the key figure in the military planning of D-Day and the subsequent operations in Northwest Europe, but rather the fact that Eisenhower had been the first head of NATO. In 53, at his behest, alternative policy evaluations were considered, including a more nuclear posture, and in the event, containment was reaffirmed. American nuclear strength, however, was to be built up at the same time as there was an attempt to define measures short of war. And that, of course, does link us directly with the present day. The idea of what deterrence means towards powers like Russia and China, but how to pursue measures short of war. The document itself, which you can look it up online, lacked attention to geographical detail, but nevertheless, alongside the broader emphases on nuclear strength and alliances, made reference to particular areas, to holding, quote, vital areas and lines of communication, and also the protection of, quote, a mobilization base adequate to ensure victory in the event of general war. General war, of course, meant nuclear war. Allies were seen as crucial. Quote, the effective use of US strategic air power against the USSR will require overseas bases on foreign territory for some years to come. Such bases will continue indefinitely to be an important additional element of US strategic air capability and to be essential to the conduct of the military operations on the Eurasian continent in the case of general war. Certain other countries, such as Indochina or Formosa, we would call Formosa Taiwan, Indochina was Cambodia, Laos, and the Vietnams, are of such strategic importance to the United States that an attack on them probably would compel the United States to react with military force, either locally at the point of attack or generally against the military power of the aggressor. Now, the last remark is, of course, interesting because what it left open was what precisely one might do. Probably would compel means we'll have to judge it at the time. Military force either locally at the point of attack or generally against the military power of the aggressor would again leave considerable discretion. So what Eisenhower was doing was saying that the United States must build up its nuclear strength in response to the Soviet acquisition of the atom bomb. And indeed, the Americans who had already started work on it, of course, got to the hydrogen bomb before the Soviets, but then the Soviets followed suit. So there was a question of both the weaponry, but also the methods of delivery of that weaponry and the basing accordingly. And of course, in the early and mid-50s, the prime means to deliver atomic weaponry as a strategic level, you could obviously plant an atomic bomb in the Fulda Gaps as mines, you could use atomic warheads on howitzers and other artillery pieces, and those were all developed in response to the prospect, which was in 1953, was a very real prospect of a Soviet attack in Western Europe, considered by Stalin for that year. But in terms of strategic air power, in other words, the dropping of bombs on major Soviet targets, and the major Soviet targets that were outlined were Moscow, Leningrad, and the industrial areas of the Donbass, eastern Ukraine. In terms of those, America needed a alliance structure which would give it effective control, certainly free use, which was effective control, not dual control, effective control of air bases from northern Iraq, places around Mosul and Kirkuk, from which they were planning to bomb the Donbass, right round, of course, to Britain, from where they were planning to bomb Leningrad and Moscow. In practice, there was no war in 53, either at the last stages of the Korean War, or, by which no war, I mean no nuclear war, or a Soviet assault on Western Europe. And nor did the Western powers intervene when there were brief popular uprisings in occupied Eastern Europe in 1953 in East Germany and in Poland. During the larger scale and far more sustained Hungarian crisis of 1956, there was also no military response to the Soviet deployment of forces to crush Hungarian independence. If one wanted to make a political point about the present day, it is interesting to contrast popular demonstrations and political fuss in 1956, because obviously, if you look at Britain, there was both about the Suez Crisis, but obviously far less criticism of the Soviet Union over Hungary. And of course, one can see, if one wishes to make the point, the same today. Many of the demonstrators today might like to consider the point that the principal killer of Arabs in the last 15 years has been the government of Syria, aided and abetted, of course, by both Iran and Russia. And yet, I don't recall demonstrations of that type. So clearly, there is, shall we say, at best a hypocritical, one might make more pointed remarks about the nature of the modern demonstrations. Anyway, going back to 1956 and the Hungarian crisis, the discussion of options then and earlier was instructive about how the geopolitics of containment, if such a phrase can be used, did not necessarily mean any particular policy and indeed had a somewhat vacuous character, which is a point that most people who work on geopolitics unfortunately do not bring out. There is a degree to which it is vacuous. There is a degree to which a lot of the literature in Britain from Tim Marshall about geography and how it causes particular things is similarly vacuous, because what they leave out is context, contingency, and agency. There was also, of course, within this so-called geopolitics, a number of very distinctive national traditions, whether those of, for example, Britain and France, as they considered how to adapt to late imperialism, how to maintain empire at the last stages, which was both policies of both in the 1950s, whether one looked at West Germany and Italy, where both countries were trying to ground the new democracies as part of NATO, or whether, for example, one looks at the Christian imperialism, explicitly Christian imperialism, of right-wing Portuguese policy under the Salazar government. It's also necessary to bring in change. Thus, the need for military cuts in the face of financial difficulties, for example, for the British Navy in the 1960s, does not really correspond to geopolitical arguments, nor do the related reconceptualization of goals and means. In other words, if you're looking at that case, and these cases can be considered more generally, it may well be that far from geopolitical or strategic culture, if you wish to use that term, considerations determining policy and therefore doctrine, strategy, and force structure for the military, you might well have a completely different pressure. For example, economic crisis, financial needs determining, or indeed industrial policy, determining force structure, and therefore you then have to create a strategy or geopolitics, so-called, accordingly. And a modern example of that would be the way in which the British built the two supercarriers, in part because of naval pressure, in part because Gordon Brown wanted to produce benefits for his home constituency in the Rosyth naval base there, and then tried to devise a geopolitics accordingly. Now, you know, it's clearly not just one or the other. That would be simplistic, as indeed so much discussion is. But nevertheless, both elements are obviously there. The coexistence of specific strategic geopolitics with options, both over the choice between these as well as their implementation, was also the case with emphases on particular fronts of containment. So you might say you want containment, but you've then got to decide, how do you put the emphasis between particular fronts, particular topics of containment, which, of course, is an issue facing the United States at the present moment, and also facing its allies, including Britain. The key instance was the balance, one that lasts to the present moment, was the balance in American commitments between Europe and Asia, insofar as you can reify either of those. I mean, Asia means, for example, everything from the Sinai Peninsula to the Kamchatka Peninsula, and there's therefore a whole range of issues. This was not some sort of fixed ratio, nor indeed necessarily a matter of holding the line in one area such that the situation was stabilized elsewhere, as with the argument today that Taiwan is being protected in, as it were, Ukraine, that you showed determination in supporting Ukraine. That is seen as deterring China in over Taiwan. Well, that's a convenient argument, and all arguments are convenient for rhetorical purposes. But the extent to which you should actually see that as an effective policy prescription is up for debate and discussion. Another key element of choice was provided by the atomic strategy pursued in and the relevant force structure. In particular, there was the question, one that was much debated from the 1950s on, and indeed was raised in a way by Vladimir Putin this year and last, whether it would be appropriate as well as possible to use tactical nuclear weapons while preventing the cataclysm of a strategic level all-out nuclear war. As with other aspects of geopolitics, and indeed, you could also mention with President Putin, clarity was less obvious than assertion in this case. And indeed, there was a whole host of debates about what you might do with your nuclear weaponry, and that therefore affected the idea of what containment meant. And in particular, the idea of holding the line, however you understand it, whether it was the inner German border, the Iron Curtain during the Cold War, or whether it was the Taiwan Straits today, is obviously affected by the ability of all sorts of weapon systems, and these days they've been amplified by drones, to fly over any line that you might construe as existing. The American sense of a bomber gap, in their term, in the mid-1950s, followed the identification of Soviet long-range heavy bombers from 1953. The Soviets had not had such a force during World War II. This led to a new set of policy emphases that focused more closely on a different geography, namely the polar routes to vulnerability and attack. In other words, it is a quicker distance to fly across the poles than it is across the Atlantic. In America, there was a stepping up of the bomber program, which indeed was part of the tension over resources and policies, both within the Air Force between the Strategic Air Command and the Tactical Air Command, with the former winning, and also between the Air Force on the one hand and the Army and the Navy on the other hand, with again, I think it's fair to say, the Air Force winning overall. There was a stepping up of secret aerial reconnaissance of the Soviet Union, which you might regard as a key element of the geopolitics of the period, and the construction of extensive early warning radar systems in Canada designed to warn of Soviet attacks over the Arctic. The Pine Tree Network in 1954, the Distant Early Warning Line in 1957, and the Mid-Canada Line also in 1957. The North American Air Defense Command, established in 1958, was important to the development of joint air defense systems involving America and Canada. This was a long way away from considering how to respond on the ground to the Hungarian crisis. And in order to attack over the North Pole, America had already constructed a base at Thule, T-H-U-L-E, in northwest Greenland in 1951-2, a base able to stage and refuel American bombers and cut the distance to the Soviet Union. Weapons technology was obviously important, not just the development of the bombs, but also the development from 1955 of the B-52 Stratofortress with its 8 Pratt & Whitney turbojets, its unfueled combat range of 3,600 miles, so that's exclusive of mid-air refueling, and its payload of 30 tons of bombs. And these capabilities enhanced from the late 50s by aerial refueling. Constant airborne B-52 alert flights began in 58. In other words, to lessen the risk of Soviet attack, aircraft were kept in the air, aircraft which would both survive any attack on American air bases, but also be able to deliver a nuclear payload against Soviet targets. Furthermore, the B-52s were complemented by 4 American supercarriers built in 1954 to 58, some of whose aircraft could carry nuclear bombs, albeit across much shorter ranges. You know, from carriers, you have a shorter runway, and you can't therefore launch such a big plane, troll in, and a lot of bombs. There was also an intellectual mastering of territory with the possibilities that offered for thinking, rethinking, and applying ideas which we might regard as strategic or, depending upon our use of language, geopolitical. And this took place at a number of levels. The SAGE air defense system, which I've already mentioned, established in 1958, reflected American investment in new technology and involved the largest computers ever built. SAGE was semi-automatic ground environment. SAGE enabled the prediction of the trajectory of aircraft and missiles and was therefore seen as an important counter to any Soviet attack. And remember, the Americans in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor were very concerned about the possibility of a surprise attack, just as, of course, the impact of the Twin Towers attacks in 2001 and now of the Hamas atrocities in Israel on October the 7th has created a similar degree to which defense planning has to build into the equation. How do you respond to the danger of a surprise attack? The internet was to be developed and funded by the Defense Department's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. Acronyms always flow all over the place, in order to help scientists using large computers to communicate with each other. The internet is essentially a matter of defense technology in its origins. At a different scale in Western Europe, new all-weather aircraft were embedded in a NATO air defense ground environment, which was an early warning system that layered fighters, long-range nuclear missiles, and short-range tactical surface-to-air missiles. Now, in theoretical terms, what you've got here, as well as in planning terms and force structure terms, is the sense that air power had transformed the situation. The leading British air power theorist, Air Marshal Sir John Slessor, wrote in 1954, quote, "Do not let us be distracted by geopolitical talk about heartlands," which was all very well in Mackinder's day, but ceased to be relevant with the advent of the long-range bomber. Now, you might agree with that, you might disagree with that. What is striking is how it tends to be totally and utterly ignored by people that run out the arguments today. Slessor's thing came from his Strategy for the West, which was published both in Britain and in New York, and he also followed up with The Great Deterrent in 1957. And I'll repeat that phrase because it's instructive and it needs thinking about, because all too many people apply ideas across time, you know, writing and using Sparta and Athens with the comments of the Thucydides as if it should explain China and America today. So, do not let us be distracted by geopolitical talk about heartlands, which was all very well in Mackinder's day, but ceased to be relevant with the advent of the long-range bomber. Swiftly afterwards was to come the intercontinental ballistic missile, of course. Specific geopolitical factors were frequently mentioned by American commentators in the 50s, and two obvious ones which we're going to look at are first the domino theory, and then the argument that the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan in 79 was a threat to the Western position in the Gulf. So I just want to start off with the domino theory, because we're going to continue with that next week. It's an important one. Let me just start off with it. The domino effect or theory argued that the fall of one country in Asia to communism would lead to that of others. Dwight Eisenhower enunciated the theory in a press conference on the 7th of April, 1954. He was questioned on the strategic importance of Indochina. Quote from him, "First of all, you have the specific value of a locality in its production of materials that the world needs. Then you have the possibility that many human beings pass under a dictatorship that is inimical to the free world. Finally, you have broader considerations that might follow what you might call the falling domino principle. You have a row of dominoes set up. You knock over the first one, and what will happen to the last one is the certainty that it will go over very quickly. So you could have the beginning of a disintegration that would have the most profound influences. The loss of Indochina, of Burma, of Thailand, of the peninsula, by which he meant Malaya, and Indonesia following. The geographical position achieved thereby does many things. It turns the so-called island defensive chain of Japan, Formosa, we call that Thailand, Taiwan, of the Philippines to the southward. It moves in to threaten Australia and New Zealand. It takes away in its economic aspects that region that Japan must have as a trading area, or Japan in turn will have only one place in the world to go, that is towards the communist areas in order to live. So the possible consequences of the loss are just incalculable to the free world." End of quote. The image of the domino theory, one readily taken from a game, an image that which was easy to communicate to politicians and public, encouraged the American government to take a greater interest in the course and consequences of the Western retreat from empire. Because the communist takeover in China was followed by effective Chinese support for the anti-French insurrection in Indochina, which led to American financial support for the French. And in 1954, which was the year that Eisenhower enunciated his theory, was the year the communists took over in North Vietnam, and the Americans were concerned that a failure to support South Vietnam and to neutralize Laos would lead to the future spread of communism in Southeast Asia. So we're going to pause at this point. But what we've got is the enunciation of a new theory, which we are going to be discussing at length next time, and we've got its context. And that is the idea that far from seeing the Cold War as fixed with the late 40s, the established Kennan's thesis, the establishment of NATO, the document of NSC 68, and so on, in fact, there is a constant flow would be the wrong term, but there are a series of conjunctures which lead to new ideas being advanced.
Right. Well, that is a very good juncture to pause, Jeremy. I'm not going to get into the discussion about domino theory, because as you say, we'll be discussing that in a future episode. But I want to focus on what I think is one of the recurring themes of your podcasts on geopolitics, and that is choices, hard choices, and particularly to focus on where costs, political realities, and technology meet. So what are the priorities? So what are the financial pressures, particularly on the United States in the 1950s. Now, 1950s is generally a time of economic success for America in the 50s. But nevertheless, is there a strong movement that says, you know, we've got to invest in things closer to home? Where is the financial trade-off between investing in longer range missiles, whether delivered from bombers or whether ICBMs that start to really come in towards the end of the 50s, as distinct from, you know, we need to secure forward bases for for shorter range contact with the communist enemy.
Well, I think that's very interesting. I mean, the financial side, as you say, is significant. There is a real problem with liquidity outside America in the Western system. So that's a big issue. It's a big issue, for example, for Britain at the time of the Korean War. As you may know, it leads to controversy in the Attlee government with the introduction of cost charges for spectacles and dentistry. In fact, those charges are not a direct consequence of the defense expenditure rising. They're more to do with the very flawed assessments underlying, ludicrously unrealistic assessments underlying the National Health Service. But there is this tension, this difficulty. And of course, one way they get round it is that the British, the French, the West Germans, when they establish it, the Italians all have conscription, as indeed do the Americans, which helps to drive down the real cost. But America, in going for air power, is actually taking advantage of its advanced industrial base, its liquidity, and a sense that the Americans have quite strongly that they don't want to put too much of a focus on conscripting too much of its manpower. So force structure is not simply a matter of geopolitics. It owes a lot to economic and indeed to cultural factors, so that the culture in Britain in the early 50s, which had conscription, is very different to the culture we have today. And that leaves aside, it's not just the attitudes of hedonism. I think these days there would be grave concern about some of the communities in Britain being their young men being trained to use firearms.
So as the European colonial empires fragment and end in Southeast Asia, what is the American geopolitical thinking in terms of, the British still have the Singapore naval base at this stage, I should point out, but you know, the French are effectively defeated in Indochine, in what's now Vietnam, and are in retreat in Cambodia. Their influence is in retreat in Cambodia and Laos. What is the sense of, well, you know, we being the Americans, we need bases here now in order to prevent what then becomes articulated as the domino theory?
Yes, I mean, that's, you're absolutely right. And I mean, Eisenhower, for example, when he's mentioning Japan in that press conference, I mean, the subtext is that Japan is where the Americans have the air bases which are supporting the deployment of their troops in South Korea. It, in fact, was the place from which the Americans deployed troops into South Korea in 1950. You lose that, you're in trouble. I mentioned last time the treaty with Spain. Spain was not a member of NATO, but the Americans brought that into the system again to provide air bases. So you're absolutely correct. There is a strong geography in that respect, obviously a geography shot through with the military possibilities and even more the political possibilities. And for the United States, there are major problems in that some of the areas which had been under the control of Western empires become either actively hostile, North Vietnam, or areas where they're not willing to have the basis of American bases. That's a horrible sentence, but you know what I mean. The obvious example being India. So there are very major problems for the Americans. Luckily, the range of aircraft is such that you don't need a base in every country.
So what's in approximate terms, because obviously aircraft vary, what is the range of the most developed aircraft in the mid-1950s for delivering heavy payloads?
Well, I gave you the figures for the Stratofortress, and I mean that I would say is the most significant one, because what it did was that it could deliver a considerable tonnage. So it was 3,600 miles and a payload of 30 tons. Now, you'll appreciate when you're talking about an unrefueled combat range, that doesn't necessarily capture the full potential range. You have not just the issue of aerial refueling, you have the situation that tailwinds or headwinds make a considerable difference. You have the extent to which cruising altitude will affect the speed at which you can go. But nevertheless, I think 3,600 miles would be a reasonable assessment. And you'll recall that during the Vietnam War, the Americans flew their B-52s a considerable distance to threaten or bomb or engage with targets in East Asia. And that was the attraction. It was also the attraction of Britain. I mean, obviously, the British air bases were in use prior to the B-52. But the attraction of Britain is that Britain was seen as a sort of aircraft of carrier off the coast of Europe. So the biggest individual American air base was the big air base, the Frank Mein air base just south of Frankfurt, but that was very vulnerable to Soviet ground forces. Whereas you could, from East Anglia, from Mildenhall or Lakenheath, you could fly and engage targets easily in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a final question, if I may, that there are a few dogs that don't bark in this period. When there is the attempted workers' uprising in East Germany, the West doesn't get involved. When there's the uprising in Hungary, the West doesn't get involved, whereas it does get, obviously, it does get involved in the Korean War. Should we see that decision not to get involved as actually a fulfillment of containment, which is to say the West, and when I say the West, I'm primarily thinking of the United States, the West takes the view that, you know, we accept the world as it was in the late 1940s. We're not trying to push back beyond that. And if we do, there lies danger. Were there other calculations in play, you know, the fear of triggering a global war itself or a major war in Europe? Eisenhower is very clear from the first that the United States is not going to get involved in the Hungarian uprising. What is the politics behind that and the geopolitical strategy?
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, of course, Eisenhower and some American commentators sort of blamed the British and the French for Suez, as it were, undercutting his options, which is, I think, ridiculous. I mean, the fact of the matter was, war over Hungary would have been probably lost by NATO, in the sense that the Allies didn't have the ground forces capable of driving back Soviet forces and Soviet allied forces in Eastern Europe. The biggest numerical part of the West's forces in NATO and Europe in the late 50s with the Bundeswehr, the new army of the West Germans, which had only just recently been founded and lacked the combat potential. The Americans had other military commitments, including a significant force in South Korea. And the Americans would have had the task of determining whether they were going to launch a nuclear conflict as soon as the Soviet ground forces were doing well. And of course, there was this illusion that which was encouraged by signs, active signs of the understandable unpopularity of communism, there was an illusion that there would be a mass uprising in Eastern Europe. But the extent to which that would have been had military potential to determine the situation is very, very, very dubious.
Mm-hmm. Well, a world of great danger we've been discussing today, and I don't think it's a plot spoiler to say it's going to get just as bad or worse in the next episode. But Professor Jeremy Rack, for talking us through the geopolitical realities of the mid-1950s, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And listeners may find my book, The Cold War, of some interest with reference to what we're talking about. It develops some of these themes at greater length. Thank you very much.